I'm Philip Rothman, and I'm here with Daniel Spreadbury, Product Marketing Manager for Steinberg's Dorico program, notation software. Daniel has been in New York City all week. So even though you've been here all week, I will welcome you to New York in any event.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Oh, great. Well, we're delighted to have you here. And Daniel, I know that you've had a busy time of it so far, talking about Dorico, going upstate, downstate, so on and so forth. But maybe mention, you know, where you've been in the last 4.5 days, five days that you've been here.
Okay, so on Monday, I went up to Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people might not realize, those people that aren't familiar with the area, that's a good 3-hour drive.
Yeah, four-hour train ride.
Yeah.
It was lovely, up past the Hudson, very beautiful scenery. It's a very beautiful part of the part of the world. And composer Rob Patterson, whose ensemble is the American Modern Ensemble, he's running a festival for the first year this year called the Mostly Modern Festival. And he's taken over a part of Skidmore College now that term is finished there. And they have a lovely brand new music facility, the Arthur Zankel Music Center there. And he's got 35 composers, mostly from the US, but actually a couple from Australia, for example, and a wide range of ages, from, you know, people who are still in their undergraduate studies right up to people who are coming to composition later in life. I think they've also got conductors and also ensembles coming in there. And they've been doing a sequence of concerts and talks around Skidmore College for sort of basically for the last week and for the next week. They finish next week. And yeah, Rob contacted me a long time ago, I guess a year ago, and invited me to come and give a talk about Dorico. They also had Bill Hollab, another famous New York person, up there a few days before me giving a talk about the sort of practical aspects of putting together performance materials and sort of things that composers should know when they're putting together materials. So my job was then to sort of come up and show them how they could use Dorico to do that. And it was good fun. I got up there on Monday night and heard a concert that made me feel very welcome. I listened to a chamber concert, which included a bunch of pieces I've never heard before, some of which were really, really stunning, in particular a guitar piece by a Czech composer, Stepan Ruck, which was really, really great. Really, really enjoyed that. And then, yeah, on Tuesday, did my talk and then came straight back to New York on the train again, another 4 hours back the other way. And then Wednesday, I lose track now, really.
And was that the impetus for your trip? That was the first?
Yeah, that was the first thing. Yes. And then the second thing is actually tomorrow's event. So tomorrow is the Music Publisher Association annual sort of luncheon and awards ceremony and so on, where they give out the Paul Revere Awards for graphic excellence and so on. And Danny Dorf from Presser invited me to come and give a Dorico presentation to the assembled members of the MPA tomorrow. So those two things were kind of like the bookend, really, for the week. And that's why I sort of came this week. And then obviously in between there, I've been trying to fit in other meetings, going to see. I was out in Brooklyn most of the day yesterday, meeting with various people. And today I've been all over the place. I've been on Broadway with the people at a bunch of people working in Broadway and film and TV music. And I've been down to Wall Street to Carl Fisher Music Publishers. And where we are right this minute is we are now at Yamaha Artist Services on Fifth Avenue and 57th or whatever it is. And I'm going to be giving a Dorico presentation to sort of people who've signed up on Eventbrite and so on in about an hour's time. So,
and I should say, a glorious day in New York City. We're sitting in a windowless practice room at the moment,
yes.
But
yeah.
It happens to be a really beautiful...
Yeah, and I've spent most of it underground on the subway,
right.
Getting very hot. Although I must say, compared to London, having air-conditioned subway cars is a real treat. So that's been pretty good.
It's definitely an improvement. Well, that sounds like a real whirlwind tour of the Big Apple. So delighted that you're able to make a little time in advance of your talk tonight. So it sounds like this Mostly Modern Festival and then the MPA being the bookends of your trip, those were fixed in the calendar, but it also tended to work out nicely with the release of Dorico Pro 2 and Elements, which just came out a few short weeks ago.
Yeah.
Was that a little bit of happenstance?
Yeah, happenstance. Totally
uh-huh.
lucky.
Okay. All right. Good.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. No, I mean, I think we always plan to get, I mean, we actually, must be a record. I think we actually hit a deadline that we set ourselves pretty much to the day. So good for us, which is the first time, I think, since any of the Dorico releases have actually come out exactly when we intended them to. So, yeah, it just happened to be the case. I would have, you know, been quite happy to do all the talks and things, even without Dorico 2 to talk about. But obviously, it's great to be able to talk about new stuff as well. That definitely helps.
And the timing of the release was actually due, you said, to mostly the academic calendar, getting that out in front of educators and students in advance of the next school year?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was, I think, when the first version of Dorico was meant to come out in the sort of late spring, early summer, and we, you know, enjoyed watching deadlines whooshing past to the great consternation of everybody in Hamburg. But yeah, we really do want to get Dorico out this time of year. If we have a big release, we'd like it to be this time of year because, you know, it is a natural time for educators to be taking stock of what they want to do in the next academic year. They're just getting their heads out of finishing terms and getting exams out of the way, at least in the northern hemisphere of the world. So it's a good time to be able to kind of talk to people about something that they might want to, as you say, add to their programs for the coming academic year.
It's interesting. I happen to notice in the long list of people that you spoke with this week, were there any educators or school teachers in the mix?
I'm not sure, to be honest. Not that I knew about. I suspect that many of the people I spoke to at Skidmore a couple of days ago, there are obviously many of them are in programs at different universities and colleges around the US. So hopefully they'll go back and tell their professors that they've seen something interesting and that they'd like to recommend that that they take a look at Dorico. So we certainly do want to get into more schools. I mean, Dorico is starting to be adopted by universities and by secondary schools. In London, we've now got Dorico into the Royal Academy of Music in all of their machines and their main composition suite, which is really, really great. And there's quite a few schools that have site licenses now in the UK. So it's starting to pick up. And we're also at the moment doing special pricing as well to try to get educators to really give Dorico a serious look, because of course if you already have Finale or Sibelius, you can upgrade to the latest version of those programs very inexpensively, much less expensively than buying in a whole new solution like Dorico. So for a limited time between now and kind of the end of what would in the UK be the October half terms, so around Halloween time, we've actually taken a whopping 60% off our education prices. So if you buy 5 or more copies of Dorico, either new licenses or cross grades, so if you've already got a site license for Finale or Sibelius, then you can actually take, you know, 60% off that price, which Dorico will still be a bit more expensive than just upgrading your current Sibelius site license or something, but it's very inexpensive in comparison to our regular pricing, and we really hope that that will give schools a good excuse to take a closer look at the program.
And I saw, I think it was either today or yesterday, that in fact the 30-day trial is now available for both software, is that correct?
That's right, yeah. Yesterday, the Dorico Pro and Dorico Elements trials were made available. So anybody who's listening to this who has previously tried, for example, Dorico 1, you can just go and get a new trial for Dorico 2 to try out the new features. So even if you had a previous trial, go and grab it and take a look and see what you think.
So speaking of what people think, what did people think this week? What was the feedback from some of the folks that you visited with?
Well, I must say, I always enjoy giving presentations to people, particularly people who use Finale a lot, because, you know, Finale obviously is a wonderfully mature program and you can do just about anything with it, but it's not always the user-friendliest program. And some things that you do in Finale can take a while. To be polite about it. And so I was showing some of the features in Dorico to the composers at the Mostly Modern Festival, and you know, they were sort of gasping and erupting into spontaneous applause just because it's like, you know, my goodness, I could do it like that, you know. So that's always really good fun. I mean, the feedback in general has been excellent. And obviously Dorico is maturing very quickly. Each update that we've released, you know, pretty much since the first version, but, you know, certainly 1.1, 1.2, and now version 2, all of them have added features that have been obviously very much wanted by the user community and needed by the user community. But I think that we continue to be able to do that in a way that really leapfrogs what other programs can do. And when people can see, you know, just how elaborate and how sophisticated our support for chord symbols are, for example, or even today when I was meeting with the Broadway arrangers and orchestrators, for them to be able to see how they could marshal their resources when working with percussion, for example, when you're thinking about a pit setup and maybe you're going to have two percussionists that are on opposite sides of the pit and you might need to sort of be able to move an instrument from one player to another, which is something that would require a lot of manual steps in either Sibelius or Finale to effectively sort of extract the music from the percussion stave that you want and paste it somewhere else and so on. And of course, in Dorico, it's a couple of clicks. You just remove one instrument from a kit, drag it to the other player. And it's those sorts of time-saving things is really what kind of knock people's socks off, because pretty much everybody I meet is using Sibelius or Finale, of course. And so what we always try to do with the features we add in Dorico is to really go above and beyond what those programs can do and think about them from first principles, really. Like, musically, what would be the most sensible way for this to work, and what would be the most expressive or the most flexible way of implementing it? And that's what we always shoot for. And I think musicians who use those programs really appreciate the fact that we don't settle for half measures. We always go as far as we possibly can to get something working as well as we can.
Is anyone that you met with actually using Dorico?
Yeah, several people have been using it. Only one of the composers at the Mostly Modern Festival is actually using it out of 35, but I think there'll be quite a few more after the presentation that I gave the other day. One of the people I met with today up in Broadway, they were using Dorico already and were very glad to hear more. And of course, we had some of the LA guys from Giant Kane Music Services on the line, as it were, sort of watching in a rather sort of Heath Robinson way with me, with my computer going up onto a screen and then them watching on Skype from a laptop on the end of the table. I'm sure that didn't work great, but they seemed to be able to follow what was going on. And
you do what you have to do sometimes.
What you have to do. Yeah. They're certainly using Dorico down there as well. I'm not sure they've used Dorico for a real film or TV project yet, but they're very keen. And, you know, their feedback, for example, was key in how we implemented things like large time signatures in Dorico too.
It's interesting. So the feedback, it seems to me, can take one of various forms. And one of those is simply, I need this feature, X, whatever it is. I need large time signatures, I need rhythm slashes, I need bar repeats, etc. But another feature, or another type of feedback rather, is a workflow request. And I wonder how you differentiate between the two in your development, because it's one thing to say, well, we can add this feature or that feature to achieve parity with the other software. But it's another thing to say, well, you know, maybe we're not going to do it like you've been used to doing it because our approach is totally different.
Yep.
And maybe you could speak a little bit to that. And that's, I think, the larger challenge for people to wrap their head around, especially those who have been accustomed to working in a certain way.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're very clear about this. You know, we don't really care how Finale or Sibelius does something. Obviously, we remember pretty well how Sibelius does most things, since we had a hand in the vast majority of what Sibelius can do. And I obviously have looked at Finale and attempted to use it many times over the years. I struggle still with it. But I think we only really, you know, we barely look at those programs. And I'm not saying that we don't care necessarily. I just said that we did not care, but it's not that we don't care what users think about the workflow they're used to from the other program. We do care very much about that. But I think that we ask them to trust us that we can actually come up with better, more logical, easier ways. And, you know, I think on the whole, we do manage to do that. I think that, you know, that we came up with a pretty strong set of paradigms when we started designing Dorico. You know, the mode, the separation into modes, the use of popovers, for example, which is unique to Dorico, despite other programs attempting to try and copy that in the lame way. But those things then give us a framework that we can hang all of the other functionality on. That's the way that we approach something new. It's like, we did think about things like rhythm slashes and repeat bars way, way back when we started designing Dorico. You know, to some degree, the things that we add in each new version, obviously in sort of I might sort of use the analogy of sort of big rocks and little rocks to make a bridge across a river, right? The big rocks are the things that we've always planned to do, whether it's cues, whether it's chord symbols and so on. We've always, those things have always been planned. And so we're sort of adding those to the program as quickly as we can because we're trying to build the bridge as quickly as we can. But we do, of course, listen to our customers as well and try to fit in smaller things that they might ask for, and those like the little small rocks that fit in between the big ones. And so I think that having put a lot of thought into how these things would work when we started years ago, you know, I think that you know, the conception of these paradigms that we have, like the modes, like popovers, like the separation of functionality, you know, so that you can use different shortcuts and different modes, all these sorts of things, that really provides the framework into which we make these workflow decisions sort of make sense, as it were. You know, things like the shift R popover, which we added just in this most recent version, I think that might have even been on the shortcut stickers that we made for version one, even though that feature never actually ended up in version one. But it shows that it was something that we were thinking about way, way back and expected to have in the program at that point. But, you know, for whatever various technical boring reasons, didn't end up happening when we first imagined it.
Right. Another example might be just the concept of different regions for different types of elements that are in the program. For instance, the way cues were implemented is something completely different than any other software program. But then once you're used to doing that, it's really not a far step to see how you put in repeat bars, for instance, or rhythm slashes or slash notation.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really much the same. And even though the way the bars are colored and the way you can zoom in and out and see
that. Yes,
see.
Exactly. So
It's interesting. When you think about these types of things, I mean, conceptually, it's very easy to think about, just to take bar repeats, for example, the concept of slapping a bar repeat symbol in a bar and say, okay, there it is, right? But it's quite another to say, well, how does that bar repeat function in terms of its relationship to the music around it, or in playback, or in layout? For instance, Dorico will not lay out music with two or four bar repeats. It won't split them up in the way that some other software does, because it really understands what the concept of that bar repeat is. Or or take chord symbols. Again, sure, anyone can type in some text and do something that reasonably looks like a chord symbol, but it's interesting in Finale. And once you start understanding how really difficult these things are, or complicated, multi-layered that they are. In Finale, you have really an unlimited way of doing it, but you have to navigate this Byzantine chord symbols dialog box, and with these suffix editors, and basically a way that's been done since the very early days of the program. Sibelius, of course, it's much easier, especially since the non-legacy chord symbols and whatever, what would you call them?
Well, I suppose you can't call them new chord symbols.
New chord symbols, right. Sibelius, Sibelius 6 plus chord symbols, which are really quite easy to use, but really limited in once you start getting into things like if you want to change how they display, or they're very limited in terms of the fonts that you can use because of the way the intricacies of the design of the different symbols. So, and then you start appreciating what it's like to try to think about that from the ground up again.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe they're very different chord symbols and bar repeats, to take two examples, but in general, what would be your approach so that you know that you can get to a place that you are confident that it works musically, it works graphically, aesthetically, and so on?
That's a big question. I mean, I think chord symbols are a great example, because we obviously did the new so-called new chord symbols in Sibelius 6. And, you know, it was always kind of part of the original design of that you should be able to use any font. That was kind of the goal. And we weren't able to achieve that because, you know, there was just a lot of complexity in that. But we sort of set ourselves the goal of not settling for something that wasn't as good as we thought it should be. You know, and we knew that, for example, in Finale, it is possible to use any font for chord symbols, because, like you say, you can go into the suffix editors, you can build a library of your own components, and you can put them together. And if you're willing to put the time in, you can get pretty good looking chord symbols with any font you like, you know. And that was really important, that, you know, that is something that other software can do. And so we wanted to be able to do that. So really the goal was to not firstly, not to have a library, which both Finale and Sibelius do. They sort of have a preset library of chords they understand, and instead to take the same algorithmic approach that we take to other things that we've done in Dorico, and to actually make it effectively have an engine for understanding chordal harmony, so that it can, you know, work out what the structure of a chord is based on just a set of notes that you throw at it. The second thing was to sort of combine the ease of use of just typing it in using sort of plain text, if you like, and playing it with a MIDI keyboard, with the ability to get really great looking chord symbols, but then to go that one step further and to make it produce automatically really great looking chord symbols with any font. And that was really the hardest bit of it. Well, was it really the hardest bit? A lot of those bits were hard, but certainly that bit took a lot of time, because we had to invent this whole sort of elastic layout system whereby each component of a chord symbol is laid out left to right and scaled according to various options and positioned in certain ways. And that really did take quite a lot of doing. But I think that, you know, I mean, again, today I showed how you could take a score and just instantly change the chord symbols into Futura or any other font you like. And it's something that, you know, people do need to do. They do need to be able to do it, or they do want to be able to do it. Mm. And it's something that is impossible in Sibelius and very laborious in Finale, and is done in a couple of clicks in Dorico. And that's always, you know, I feel like we've done our jobs well when you can basically reduce an incredibly complex problem or something that is simply impossible in another program to a couple of clicks. Then I feel like we've really, you know, we've hit our mark then.
Sometimes you make things look too easy, and that's deceiving as well. And it sets expectations sometimes unreasonably high. It's interesting, as we're talking here, you start thinking about the wide variety of music, of musical styles, of musical formats that any professional notation software has to work with. And, you know, whether by careful planning or a bit of good fortune or perhaps a bit of both, I think in your week here, you've really covered the gamut from, you know, contemporary composers writing fresh off the press music at the Mostly Modern Festival. You've spoken with engravers, like you said, that are using it at a very high professional engraving standard level. But then, of course, today you met with the Broadway folks, and sometimes the main focus there, even though you always try to produce something that looks as good as possible, is to try to get it on the stand as quickly as possible, as readable as possible, in a minimum amount of time, with a minimum amount of fuss. So you have arrangers and copyists dealing with their own demands. And then, of course, tomorrow you're seeing the publishers, and their goal is to produce something that will last for all time, or at least will sell enough copies to make back their investment in the music. So, you know, like I said, a professional software package has to meet all of those demands. So I was just wondering, like, to what extent do those demands overlap? How do they diverge? And, you know, ultimately, can Dorico meet all of them?
Yeah, well, I certainly think that Dorico can meet all of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was. We've always sort of talked about four key groups that we're trying to appeal to. There's students and teachers, there's composers and arrangers, there's publishers and engravers and copyists, basically, and then people working in media music. And those have always been the four groups that we have in mind when we're thinking about what we're developing and how we're approaching it. And I genuinely think that when it comes to the use of software like Dorico in education, there's sort of two main groups of uses. There's basically using it in the classroom actually with students, and there's not. And if you're not using it in the classroom with students, then you're basically doing the same job as a composer or an arranger or a copyist or whatever it might be. You know, you're then using it to prepare a score for some reason, whereas I think classroom use is different, because you're actually trying to get kids to understand theory or to experiment with composition, these sorts of things. So I think there's a genuine divide there, but I think otherwise those other three groups the ones that aren't involved in actually using software in the classroom, there is a great deal of overlap between them, but of course they all have their own special areas that they're most focused on. Like you say, for if you're working on a Broadway show or a film score, then legibility and speed are the two key things. If you're working in engraving and publishing, then, as you say, something beautiful that's going to last for all time. I mean, obviously speed is also helpful in that environment too. And, you know, one of the things that I was explaining this afternoon is that you really want to be able to make with Dorico parts and scores that look as if they have had a great deal of editorial work done on them, without having to lift an editorial finger at all, if you possibly can. You know, increasingly, that's the feedback we hear from people, particularly people who are switching from other programs. It's like, you know, they almost can't believe that they can get parts that look as good as the ones that Dorico produces without basically touching them. And again, I sort of feel like we've done our job then. I think so for everybody, whoever you are, our goal is that you should be able to get to the end result you want as quickly as possible and with as little interference as possible, both ways. You shouldn't have to interfere with the program much, and the program shouldn't get in your way. And that's really sort of what we're trying to achieve. And I think that, you know, the core of Dorico has been great right from the beginning. You know, even version 1.0 back in October, the things that it notated absolutely beautifully with details that other programs just don't have. But the thing that is really great from my point of view as I, you know, work with the team, and, you know, the team are absolutely amazing. I think they are the best people working on this kind of software anywhere in the world, without question, is that they can maintain that commitment to graphical fidelity, maintain that commitment to making the program do what you expect it to do, for it to be stable, for it to be, you know, relatively bug-free as these things go, and to achieve all of that whilst building on this core of graphical excellence and musical flexibility. I think that, you know, that is really what sets Dorico apart and what makes it fit each of those target groups, you know, increasingly well. Obviously, each of them is missing little bits and bobs here and there, or some, in some cases, big bits and bobs. But as we continue to develop as quickly as we do and keep adding these things to Dorico, the program becomes, I hope, closer and closer to the ideal software for each of those four groups.
So you mentioned the Dorico team, and then, of course, you also mentioned one of your key constituent groups of consumers, the music and media folks. Well, one of the new features in Dorico, of course, is the video element, and you not only have the Dorico team that you can call upon, but you also, of course, have the Steinberg team that has expertise and experience working on that. So how much did that play into getting that ready and shipping into Dorico?
Well, there was no way we would have done it without them. So even though the engine that they have developed, there's a team working on the video engine in Hamburg, which first arrived in the new version of Nuendo last year, really all brought about because Apple have kind of ditched support for QuickTime in 32-bit apps and on Windows altogether. So and a lot of video apps are reliant on QuickTime, or have been reliant on QuickTime, and it's obviously a bit of a technical sort of bugaboo that you have to deal with that issue. And so they've been working on this sort of high performance video engine, which is still a little limited in terms of the codecs and things that it supports, but is, you know, there's plans to continue to improve that.
You're talking about the various file formats exactly. That someone can use.
That's right. So, I mean, you know, generally speaking, I made sure I went out and I talked to people who were in the industry to make sure that, you know, what sort of formats do they really see on a day-to-day basis? And you know, fortunately, the coverage of formats that Dorico has, which is the same as what Cubase and Nuendo can work with, which, of course, was itself as a result of lots of, you know, discussion with people in the industry to make sure that it served their needs. But I sort of double checked to make sure that there wasn't anything that was for some reason different in the world of scoring for, you know, with actual notation rather than just doing it in the box in Cubase or whatever. And, you know, generally speaking, it's, you know, HD MP4 files. That's kind of what people tend to work with. So they had that support nailed down, and but we still had to work with them very closely to actually figure out how to take, because the architecture of programs like Cubase, Nuendo, and Dorico are obviously very different, and the technical foundation is very different. So to then be able to integrate that, and of course, sort of doubly complicated, it also has to integrate with the audio engine as well, which is itself a separate application that Dorico talks to in real time. So to be able to basically make sure that the video would spit out an audio file that the audio engine could then read, and then have the audio engine actually drive the sync in the video engine and in Dorico's playback, was quite an interesting triangular technical challenge to solve.
But ultimately that ends up being more stable than doing it perhaps another way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that we now have as a result, because the audio engine is sample accurate, of course, and video files, of course, they you know, they're not necessarily frame accurate, these compressed formats, because they have keyframes and then deltas and so on. Is that you can, you know, through that whole mechanism, we can make sure that the sync is absolutely rock solid, and it doesn't even drift, you know, even by a frame, basically. So it's really, really pretty good, I would say, in terms of the fidelity of how the video is synced to the audio engine, which is in turn synced to the score. And I think that, you know, that will only continue to improve. The great advantage of having these components that are part of Cubase and Nuendo is that they're being developed all the time. You know, these are things where, you know, we, for example, in Dorico 2 now have a high DPI capable audio engine. So plugin windows show in high DPI, whereas Dorico itself was high DPI right from the beginning, the audio engine was not. And even though Cubase is not yet high DPI, you can guess that the next version probably will be, because the audio engine which we're using, which is a big part of the sort of Cubase code base, is now high DPI. And so we get those, you know, those improvements sort of naturally come into Dorico by way of the fact that we have this, you know, component chunk that comes from other products. So it's really very good. And I think that, you know, other scoring programs tend to have kind of turnkey bits of stuff that they've licensed from third parties in order to manage things like audio engine and this kind of stuff. And for example, neither Finale nor Sibelius can support VST3 plugins, and whether they will or not in the future, who knows. But Dorico can. And, you know, as these things sort of move forward, as Cubase supports new stuff, new formats of plugins, whatever they may be, and not that I know that there will be one, but you know what I mean, that will just naturally be part of Dorico, because, you know, it's part of this living ecosystem of technologies that Steinberg is maintaining and developing and building.
It's interesting. It recalls the review that we did on scoring notes a couple of weeks ago, which I hope everyone will read. It's a long read, but yep.
Make a pot of tea and strap
it. We had five expert reviewers each take a chunk because there was so much to cover, and really lend their expertise to giving readers an unfiltered, unbiased opinion of it. And when we concluded the review, we called Dorico the trailblazer compared to the other programs based largely on the types of things that you're talking about, with some of these types of technologies that are at the vanguard. And it's certainly not meant to disparage other software, because the other software programs do have some very good features, real advantages, and they are continuing to be developed. But it's really simply a recognition that it's more difficult to innovate when you have a large installed user base for whom radical change could be disruptive, and you have to maintain more of a legacy set of software products. But speaking to that, and perhaps the innovation that you're doing right now, I know maybe it's trying to pick one of your favorite children, but clearly you're proud of many of these things. But is there anything in particular that you are proud of, any type of feature or any type of way that the software works?
Well, I think it is like picking your favorite child. So it's difficult, and I think that the amazing thing is, looking at what we did in Dorico 2, for example, is that, you know, everybody on the team worked and, you know, sometimes on more than one thing over the course of a very short development period, really, to get all those features done. And, you know, I sort of think back on the achievements that every member of the team made towards getting Dorico 2 into the shape that it's now in. And, you know, really every single member on the team did incredible work. I mean, I think my favorite feature in terms of just how cool it is in terms of Dorico 2 is the Divisi feature. I just think that is an absolute knockout feature. And again, it's something that we talked about right at the beginning, back in the early months of 2013, before we actually wrote even one line of code. We had this idea that Divisi, and this is why, you know, in every demo I've ever given of Dorico, even version one, I would always explain the difference between solo players and section players by saying that solo players can double and section players can divide, except they can't. And that's because it was always planned right from the very, very beginning. And you know, we had this idea early on that it should work by dynamically adding staves, and it should be able to automatically show the unison music when that changes midway through a system. And it was always part of the plan, and large bits of architecture were built in the early days of building the software that would provide the sort of framework that would allow this to happen. So it's not like we sort of dreamed it up overnight and then managed to make it work. We'd actually been working towards it very steadily for a period of years, basically. But nevertheless, when you actually see unison music automatically copied down onto the other stage, well, I say copied down, it's not copied down, it's just there. It's not copied there, it's just there, it's naturally there. And that really, for me, is I think, is an example of where the design decisions that we made early on continue to pay dividends day by day, by year by year. And, you know, we don't just kind of throw this stuff together, basically, is the point. And so when it actually really comes together in the way that we imagined it would 5 years ago, that is a real, you know, thrill for me to see that. And, you know, I always remember, there's days I'll remember my whole life where you see something happen for the first time, like the first day I saw a note move in a score and a part in Sibelius 4 back in those days, and the first day we saw the notes actually jump off the stave when magnetic layout was first developed by Davy, and early in Dorico's development, the first day when Dorico, as a kind of an embryonic application, the first day you could actually put in a note and the whole edit loop happened and so on. But also seeing Divisi unison assignment work for the first time earlier this year was just as much of a thrill as any of that, because it really, as I say, is sort of the payoff for a great deal of careful thought and design, and of course an enormous amount of very difficult engineering work that the team has undertaken, and Andrew in particular who worked on that feature, at least, you know, this bit, the stave assignment bit that sort of made all of it possible, was worked on by him and by James years ago. It's just an absolute thrill to see it. And as I say, although I think all of the features we've added in Dorico 2 are really valuable and really well implemented and really slick and really address the use cases that we set out to address, the Divisi feature for me is the one that gives me the giggles when I see it, because I just think it's so unbelievably cool. And it's the kind of thing that other programs just will never be able to do.
It may or may not be the same thing, but in your demos this week, what has been the feature or features that have gotten the most oohs and ahs?
Well, chord symbols always get a big ooh and an ah. Mm. You know, it was obviously not having chord symbols in Dorico 1.0 was very painful for everybody. But I think that, you know, that's very fortunately long forgotten now, not by us, because, you know, we carry these scars forever, but by our customers, at least, that Dorico really does have these great chord symbols. And yeah, when one of the young composers in Skidmore College asked me, you know, so what about chord symbols? And then I start to show them how it works. You know, they sort of almost can't believe their eyes in terms of how sophisticated it is and how much easier it is than either of the other programs. So that one's always a good one. I think with the Broadway crowd today, cues probably was the thing that kind of was the clincher for them. And again, I think, you know, that cues feature is another thing that just makes me smile when I see it work, because, you know, again, we thought so carefully for such a long time ago about how that would work, and then to actually be able to kind of build steadily onto the core concepts that we put in order to make that happen has been I really salute the team, because they take ideas that, you know, maybe I had the germ and maybe somebody else did, we work on them together to kind of build them up and then to sort of figure out what the design is going to be that's going to make them possible, and to sort of see them emerge fully formed and working really sort of even better than I could have imagined when we dreamed it up. It's still a thrill. And the thing that excites me most is that as we look forward into the future, I have many, many more of those experiences to look forward to, because we still have a lot of very exciting things planned. You know, we're not done, not even by half yet. So there's an awful lot more to come.
And I know better not to ask what those things are at this time. And you've cleverly given us that bit just as we're out of time for the interview, as you have to go give.
So not my first radio.
But nevertheless, it'll be fun to see you demonstrate some of the new features of Dorico 2 to the assembled crowd here at the Yamaha Artist Services in New York City. And the last question I have for you is, isn't New York City just the greatest city in the world?
It's not bad. I mean, it's no London, but it's not bad.
Well, I guess that's the best we can hope for today. Well, you're welcome back anytime to our city, and definitely thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks Philip. Okay. Cheers. Yeah.